Carton or WVOX alum John Bronstein.
WVOX and WVOX Worldwide at WVOX.com now has program time available for rising young sports broadcasters.
And you can now produce or host an hour or half hour for your own sports talk show.
Our David O'Shaughnessy has all the details about special reduced airtime costs for independent sports talk producers.
Call David now to reserve your own weekly time slot and start booking your own guests. 914-636-1460. 914-636-1460 for special prices for sports talk show hosts on WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
Updated weather forecast for your Thursday. It's the last day of June. We've got a beautiful day once again. Plenty of sunshine. Our highs will reach the lower 80s. Then clear skies tonight. Evening readings generally between 75 to 80 up to around 9 p.m. Then overnight lows cool and comfortable in the upper 50s by daybreak Friday. And we open up July with mostly sunny day on Friday. Nice isolated shower or thunderstorm later afternoon in a few spots most of the places. And most of the time it'll be dry and rain-free Friday. Highs tomorrow, 80 to 85. Lows at night, back to the lower 60s. Saturday features sunshine into the middle 80s. Sunday partly sunny, a chance of a late-day thunderstorm or highs back to the upper 80s on Sunday. Then the 4th of July holiday on Monday. Mostly sunny in the upper 80s. And our extended forecast looks like the fair, warm but dry weather will continue right in through the middle of next week. Tuesday and Wednesday, sunshine, middle to upper 80s Thursday of next week. It looks like we'll have sunshine, but a late-day thunderstorm and highs near 90. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather is brought to you on WVOX Worldwide by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Jim Caloran, John Verney, Michael Brown, and the Soundshore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
Wherever you listen.
In the shower.
I listen to it all the time. I listen at work, in my car, when I get up.
Thanks for keeping it here. WVOX Worldwide.
The voice of Westchester. 1460 WVOX.
Good morning. Welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education and culture, and chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, June 30th, 2011, the 10th day of summer. We are shortly after the longest day of the year, which occurred 9 days ago on June 21st, and we have lost 2 minutes of daylight since last we met 1 week ago. Days will continue to shorten until the winter solstice, December 22nd this year. The sun rose 5:26 this morning. It will set at 8:31 this evening. We will have 15 hours and 5 minutes of daylight today. By contrast, the winter solstice will be 11 hours and 14 minutes, almost 4 hours difference between the longest and the shortest days. The moon is up right now. It will set at 8:02 this evening. You know what that means when the moon sets round about sunset. It means that we are at the new moon, which we reach tomorrow morning. Next full moon is July 15th. Summertime, summertime, summertime. Next high tides in New Rochelle shortly at 11:18, about an hour and 9 minutes, an hour and 8 minutes. In Yonkers, it is high now. It turned high about a half hour, 35 minutes ago, 9:25. in Haverstraw. It is just turning high right now. If you're looking at the tide in Haverstraw, I beg your pardon. Tarrytown. If you're looking at the water right now in Tarrytown, you are looking at the full high tide. Haverstraw will get high at 10:35, Peekskill at 10:48. So we're all around high right now. Our regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives at war. May they live on in all of our hearts. Specialist Nicholas Charlie D. Hensley, age 28, of Prattville, Alabama. He was with the 1st Infantry Division. He was injured by a roadside bomb in Kandahar Province, Afghanistan, on June 15th. He died 9 days later, June 24th, in Landstuhl, Germany, just 6 days ago. 1st Lieutenant Dimitri A. Del Castillo, age 24, of Tampa, Florida. He was with the 25th Infantry, one of two soldiers killed by small arms fire in Kunar Province on June 25th, which is 5 days ago. The other soldier killed with Lieutenant Del Castillo was Staff Sergeant Nigel D. Kelly, age 26, of Menifee, California, also with the 25th. And they were killed together on the 20th. They were from the 25th. Infantry, and they were killed on the 25th of June. A sad irony. And finally, Sergeant Marlon E. Myrie, age 25, of Oakland Park, Florida. He was with the 2nd Marine Division, killed in combat in Helmand Province on June 25th, just 5 days ago. These four American soldiers were alive on the day of our broadcast last Thursday. You must not forget that there are troops in the field who are alive today and will no longer be alive when next we meet in 2 weeks. That thought really should be with you. You should carry that with you. Whatever your politics, it makes no difference. Far right, far left. These are our guys, and they're dying, and they will continue to die as long as the war continues, as long as war continues, which I suppose will always be. Each death is a great loss to their families and to all Americans. May they live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions. You have the right to disagree with them because everyone has the right to be wrong. This week, we review the American Ballet Theater production of The Bright Stream. I did not see this, but my associate, Sandra Prosnitz, did. She wrote this review. So if it's completely wrong, if you completely disagree with it, you can call her up. But she's very astute, very knowledgeable, very loves the dance. So I presume it is a very astute review. American Ballet Theatre's production of The Bright Stream was fabulous, and it played to an appreciative capacity audience. It is fall on a Soviet collective farm in the 1920s, and a group of famous dancers arrives to help with the Harvest Festival. The locals are very taken with their attractive visitors, and several of them waste no time trying to make romantic assignations. One of the faithless is Pyotr, an agricultural student. He flirts shamelessly with the ballerina, but she is an old friend of his wife, Zina, and assures Zina that she has no interest in Zina's husband. The company then plots to punish the amorous peasants. Everybody changes roles. Zina will dress up as the ballerina. The ballerina will don male clothing, and the male ballet dancer will wear a dress. I imagine that was a sight to see. In the second act, they are all in disguise, including a male dancer dressed as a dog to protect a schoolgirl. And this gives an opportunity for cross-dancing as well as cross-dressing. Paloma Herrera, as the ballerina, does a solo in typical male style, complete with high kicks and strong jumps. And David Halberg, as the ballet dancer, dances the woman's solo. Mr. Halberg is taller than anyone else in the company, and to see him on point, that means on his toes, in case you are not familiar with the terminology, floating around the stage in a romantic tutu was worth the price of admission all by itself, says Sandra. I don't know if I could handle that. It was an entertaining parody, and he clearly relished the opportunity to show his comedic ability. Dramatically, this was one of the best performances I have seen at ABT. All the principals really got into their characters, and because they were having so much fun, the audience had a great time, too. It's a comedy, so everything gets sorted out. All ends happily. Alexei Ratmansky's choreography was wonderful throughout, and the brisk pace keeps the audience engaged all the way through. Sets and costumes, admirably simple, showed none of ABT's unfortunate tendency to overdress the stage. She especially liked the main backdrop of a field of grain against the sky, giving the impression of fertile land going on forever. And I guess that this would be the Bright Stream, the bright field of grain going on forever. This ballet was first performed in Russia in 1935, very popular with audiences, but the Soviet authorities felt it mocked the hardworking peasants, and it quickly closed. The very well-known composer, Dmitri Shostakovich, who wrote this, was severely chastised and never wrote another ballet, which was a huge loss for dance audiences. The music for The Bright Stream is truly bright, bright. My guest today is Tracy Mincer, oceanographer and microbiologist with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Dr. Mincer formerly spent much time beneath the sea as a scuba diver doing field research. Now he leaves the getting wet to assistants in his lab. Welcome from Woods Hole, Dr. Tracy Mincer.
Hello, Bob. Thanks.
Good morning. Good morning. How's the weather today up in Massachusetts?
Fantastic.
Yeah, not too hot, not too cold, bright and shiny.
Like it should be.
Just like it is here. this is just a little side thing. It has nothing to do with what you do, but when I was researching your work, I noticed that there is a Tracy Mincer who was a custom pipe maker. Do you know about him?
Yeah, this is my grandfather, yeah.
Oh, he really was?
Yeah.
So are you named after him?
I am, yes.
Oh, cool. So when I looked up Google Images and I saw a bunch of pipes, it was no coincidence.
No coincidence at all, yeah.
Do you smoke a pipe?
I have in the past, and I have a small collection. Some of the first ones that my grandfather made, which is kind of fun.
And it must be valuable, right?
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. It is to me, yeah.
Okay, now, one more little light thing before we get into your work. Do people tell you that you look like Tom Hanks?
Oh, God, yeah, there's a lady at the place where I get lunch, says it all the time.
And she asks for your autograph every day? Well, we had a little disagreement in our house. I showed one friend your picture, and she said, not at all. And I showed the other guy, said, oh, of course, that's the guy from Forrest Gump. So there you go. So you do and you don't. Depends on who's looking.
That's right.
Okay, now, June 8th. Was World Oceans Day. It was a UN General Assembly mandate or whatever. The theme was either our oceans greening our future or youth, the next wave for change. What they basically said is the oceans account for about 70% of the Earth's surface, I guess we know, and they're facing diverse challenges ranging from depleted fishery resources to the impacts of climate change and deterioration of the marine environment. Do you have anything to say about that? Were you involved with that conference?
I was not, but I certainly, you know, I'm very aware of all this because it's a big message in our field. I think it's just things are happening so fast right now. And when a fishery collapses, it happens very quickly. And I think what we want to do is try to understand some of the warning signs and understand the ocean better. And we're just now, robotics and buoys that can measure a lot of different types of data and help us. Now we're learning how to interpret these data. It's a big time right now in understanding the ocean, understanding our planet, and really what is the heart and lungs of our planet, the ocean.
Sure. Now, when you say things are happening so quickly now, what does that mean in the next 30 seconds?
Okay.
And then
yeah,
we'll come back after the break, of course.
Fast. Things are happening very rapidly with the changes in the acidifying of our oceans and other things that we're putting into the ocean.
Okay. All right. Let's leave it at that. We'll come back to that question when we return in just a couple of minutes. Thank you very much. You are listening to WVOX AM 1460, originating in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Sagadore, Michigan, Grenoble, France, Stoke-on-Trent, England, Lodge, South Carolina, or Worcester, Massachusetts, you have logged on to www.wvox.com. You are listening live. I am Bob Lebensold. The program is Environmentally Sound. My guest is Dr. Tracy Mincer of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. And we will be right back.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
from the Fox Business Network, stocks are higher in early morning trading as optimism over Greece's austerity plan puts the markets on track for a fourth straight day of gains. At 10 a.m. Eastern, the Dow was up triple digits, up 110 points. New claims for jobless benefits were mostly unchanged last week. It's the latest evidence that the struggling economy isn't creating many jobs. Claims fell by just 1,000 to 428,000, falling short of expectations. The number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits has topped the 400,000 mark for 12 straight weeks, and economists say anything over 400,000 is not good. NASDAQ is considering making a bid for the London Stock Exchange. Fox Business has learned that merger talks between the two companies have not yet started, but could begin in the next few weeks. Yesterday, the Toronto Stock Exchange dropped its planned merger with the LSE. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
This 4th of July, read SEAL Team 6, the instant best-selling book about SEAL Team 6, the elite unit that got bin Laden. The New York Times calls SEAL Team 6 adrenaline-laced, comparing it to a Tom Clancy novel. SEAL Team 6 explains how this covert combat squad is able to precisely execute missions like the bin Laden operation. When the Navy needs the best, they send the SEALs. And when the SEALs send their best, they send SEAL Team 6. SEAL Team 6, the instant best-selling book by Howard Wasten and Stephen Templin. On sale now.
Welcome to Free Radio.
Free.
No download fees, no subscription fees, and
it's accepted by the American Dental Association.
WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD3.
1460 WVOX.
We are back. This is Bob Levinson. We're speaking with Dr. Tracy Mincer of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He is a microbiologist and an oceanographer. Welcome back, Dr. Mincer.
Thank you.
Okay, you were talking about how things are happening so quickly now. Now, I've been following the oceans as a member of Oceana, and I've interviewed many people that are concerned with the oceans. And I don't know exactly what you mean by things are happening so quickly, because it seems to me that the deterioration has been going on for such a long time. So what is it actually that's happening now that that has speeded up somehow?
Well, I think when you look at, for example, a collapsing of a fishery, there's a certain sustainable curve, and then there's a breaking point at which once that population that can mate and reproduce and is harvested beyond, you know, a certain mm-hmm. sustainable point, it just completely collapses. It's a very sharp, precipitous
but fall. But fisheries have been collapsing. I know the cod fishery in the North Atlantic, correct me if I'm wrong, crashed some time ago, and the tuna are almost gone. I mean, is it accelerating to where fisheries are going at an even quicker rate now?
I think as taking us into a historical context, I grew up in Alaska, and fishing was excellent for many, many years, and then all of a sudden, it just stopped. It stopped being productive, and a lot of people thought, "Well, this is never going to happen to us up here in Alaska," but it did. And I think that's the surprise: is once we learn more about how things work in ecology and in these special habitats, we could have actually maybe even predicted some of this earlier. It didn't help that there was an oil spill and things like that.
Well, did the oil spill affect the fisheries?
I believe there's some data that show that it did. It recruitment of certain larvae and things like that. It hit them.
Now, Dr. Mincer, let me just ask you to speak directly into the phone.
Okay.
You're going in and out. Yeah, there you go.
Right. So that did have an effect in the recruitment of certain larval populations.
Okay.
And using that as an example or a metaphor for us to understand what's happening on other levels, I think is important. Just the basic principles, the underpinnings of how the ocean works, what its contributions are to environment that we like to live in, right? And production of oxygen, the recycling of necessary nutrients in the ocean, and things like like this are all very basic understandings that we're just now beginning to really understand better and understand the ocean's crucial role in maintaining.
Okay, again, correct me, but as I say, I've been following the oceans for some time. Of course, you have even longer and much more in depth. But it's been my impression that the oceans were on their way to almost sterility, or certainly losing their ability to feed the millions of people who depend on it for years. And I'm just wondering if it's just still going apace, or if it's actually speeding up now to where the end is even closer in the future than we imagined.
Well, So things can come back, too. And it's been shown off the coast of Monterey, where just as little as 10 years ago, there was a reserve that was made, and the fish populations are beginning to come back, too. But it's delicate, and it's hard. I think the biggest problem with the ocean is monitoring and understanding, because we can't see everything in the ocean, and we're just now beginning to get tools to monitor ocean health and to see fish populations, understand how many are there and how many what we take when we really do harvest, and how devastating, for example, the dragging of the bottoms of the ocean are with these big, huge trawling nets, for example.
Yeah.
Things like that. And of course, this has been happening for quite some time. I mean, we see it as
sure.
a long time, but in the history of the oceans, this is
spike,
you know.
Of course, it's just since man has been fishing from big boats, and actually quite recently.
Right. And even places that used to be very productive, it's just amazing how quickly things can collapse. I mean, within one or two seasons, all of a sudden, it's there's this devastating collapse.
Okay, so what are the consequences to the world's population, those who depend on fish and perhaps those who depend on selling fish and perhaps all of us? What are the consequences of this kind of destruction of the ocean to all of us?
Oh, well, I mean, of course, we can eat other things, but I think it matters, I think, to more people that remember how things were, and having that for the future generations, you know, our children, to be able to know, you know, what a school, being out on the water and seeing a school of dolphins, or seeing a big boil of bluefish come up and feed, you know, that kind of thing is really pretty amazing.
Okay, that's the aesthetics of the ocean. But
right.
But you say we can eat other things. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that if the oceans lost their ability to feed populations, millions would die of starvation because of that. Am I not? Is that wrong?
I think certainly that's true. And we're getting out of my area of expertise. I think it's possible for humans to eat stuff other than just seafood, but
if they're available. But these people who eat, subsistence populations who live by the sea, they can't afford anything else either.
Nah, it's true. And some of these island populations and such, they just
right.
don't have the means to grow.
Sure, and much of Asia
farm or
right.
you know, agriculture
exactly.
And,
mm-hmm. How do you feel about the work of Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Society?
I'm really not very familiar with it.
Okay, well, perhaps I'll send you an email because I think you should know about him. What
sure,
he did,
sure.
he's the activist who goes out and challenges the Japanese illegal whale poaching vessels in the South Australian seas, and also who brought the slaughter of the baby seals up in Newfoundland, or was it Nova Scotia? I'm not sure by my Canadian geography. Okay. I'd like first, we're going to get into plastics, the Sargasso Sea, and things that are in your area of expertise. But before we take our next break, let me just ask you, do you miss getting into the water and doing hands-on field work?
Oh, I try to get out a couple times a year at least, and still get the chance to get my hands wet every once in a while.
You enjoy that, right?
I love it, yeah.
I should think so, yeah. Okay, just hang on a couple of minutes. We have another break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Tracy Mincer of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460, New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Friendship, Wisconsin, Weatherby Lake, Missouri, Stanley, North Carolina, Douglas, Wyoming, Dublin, Ohio, or Ireland, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. I am Bob Lebensold. This program is Environmentally Sound. We come to you the second and fourth, and as it happens, the fifth Thursdays of each month. We are speaking with Dr. Tracy Moon.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Pam Puso, paying tribute at the Pentagon to a job well done. Defense Secretary Robert Gates retiring after more than 4 years on the job. President Obama awarding Gates the Medal of Freedom.
A man of common sense and decency. Quite simply, one of our nation's finest public servants.
Gates being replaced by CIA Director Leon Panetta. The Senate could confirm Panetta's replacement today, General David Petraeus. Next week, Senate recess, nixed by Majority Leader Harry Reid.
With liberty comes responsibility. We should take that responsibility seriously.
Deficit negotiations hitting a wall.
There's still so much to do to put Americans back to work. Cut our deficit. Get our economy back to work.
President Obama wants more tax revenue. Republicans, who also called for a session next week, only want spending cuts. Fox News, we report, you decide.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy. You know, I've been telling you about Mario's, the legendary Italian restaurant in the Bronx, I think, for over 25 years, I guess. Actually, Mario's has been there on Arthur Avenue in the Little Italy Belmont neighborhood now for 91 years, since 1919. You've heard countless stories from me here on the radio about Joseph and Barbara Meliucci and before them, Mario and Mama Rose of sainted memory. I've told you I know about the warm, caring waiters and the great service, the valet parking, and how they do great parties, how nice they are to kids. I think you know all of it by now and how it's a perfect stop in your way to and from the Bronx Zoo, the Yankees, Fordham, or Botanical Gardens. And I also expect by now you know of my enthusiasm for Mario's and my great affection for the owners. But never once, it now occurs to me, have I told you how really reasonable Mario's tabs are. I'm reminded you can get a great lunch for $12.95, I mean a big, full, great lunch, and at night, a full four-course dinner for just $29.95. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, all the great stuff, veal marsala, sorrentino, chicken scarpiello and francese, homemade lasagna, eggplant parmesan, filet of sole, fresh and salmon, all from the regular menu for under $30 for everything. Or my own favorite, I just ordered a Mario's individual pizza. It's legendary, and a salad. I got to tell you, Mario's for lunch or dinner early in the week, like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, is one of the best dining buys today. And you know, they're such great people, which means they don't scrimp, they don't cut back with the low prices during the week. It's off Fordham Road, 718-584-1188. I know that one by heart, 718-584-1188.
With a modest adjustment to your daily routine, you can decrease your risk for heart disease and increase your sense of well-being. Writing a prescription is easy. Just take two well-fitted shoes, add some comfortable clothing, include a few stretching exercises, followed by a 30-minute walk once a day, most days of the week. Oh, and remember, there is no copay, and refills are unlimited. Sound Shore Medical Center encourages you to speak with your healthcare professional before starting any exercise routine.
Here's the updated weather forecast for today. We've got sunshine or high temperatures reaching the lower 80s, northwest winds at around 10 to 15. For tonight, mostly clear. Nighttime readings into the upper 50s. It'll be mostly sunny on Friday for the first day of July. Our highs for the day, back to 80 to 85. An isolated shower, thunderstorm, later afternoon, early evenings, only about 20% chance. But at night, it'll be clear with nighttime lows in the lower 60s. Sunny and warm on Saturday, 83 to 88 degrees. Partly cloudy at night. And Sunday, partly sunny. Late day, thunderstorms. Our highs in the upper 80s. 4th of July, mostly sunny. Upper 80s again. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
It's too hot.
Helping you keep your cool all summer long. AM 1460, WVOX.
1460, WVOX.
We are back. My guest today is Dr. Tracy Mincer of the Oceanographic, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
Hi. Okay, now, the reason I reached out in the first place was I read a piece in either the Scientific American or the New York Times about how plastics, which are supposedly biodegradable, not biodegradable, have been breaking down both on land and in the sea. What do you say about that?
Right. It has been shown that in landfills that certain plastics that weren't thought to be biodegradable, that microbes can actually hydrolyze or break them down. But what hasn't really been shown is this effect in the ocean, and in a recent survey from some samples that we collected from an area called the Sargasso Sea, which is in the North Atlantic.
Dr. Mincer, please talk right into the phone.
Sure.
Thanks.
It's in the North Atlantic and the Sargasso Sea, and this is a very nutrient-limited regime, off the coast of Bermuda in that area there.
But it's 1.4 million square miles, so it's huge, really.
Exactly, and this is the center of what's called the North Atlantic Subtropical Gyre. It's a giant whirlpool. And there was an expedition that was carried out by the Sea Education Association and collaborators there, my collaborators there, and I encourage you to go to their website where they have some nice documentation of this recent trip.
And what website is that?
It's sea.edu.
sea.edu/plastic. But was that F as in Frank or S as in C?
S.
Okay. FEA.
Education.
.edu. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of these plastic samples, they end up being ground up into confetti overall, and they're very hard to see. It's not like there's just a bunch of bottles and things floating around in the water there. You have to use a net and tow it along and then count these small flecks of plastic that
okay.
are there.
Okay.
And these flecks of plastic, when we looked at them by electron microscopy, we
wow.
saw that they were just loaded with microbes.
So let me just ask you this. Are the microbes actually digesting them and changing them chemically, or are they just breaking them into smaller bits of the same plastic?
Well, we thought that basically maybe it was just UV light and weathering and physical forces and such that were breaking this stuff down until we really found some what we believe is pretty good evidence for certain microbes to be able to burn through or hydrolyze and melt this stuff and degrade it chemically. So that's the subject of some of our recent work, and we are
ready
to submit that.
And we also know that there's a great competition in the Sargasso Sea for phosphorus. It's very short of phosphorus. Is there phosphorus in these plastics, and is that perhaps where they're getting it?
Yeah, that's a great question, but plastics really don't have many nutrients in them at all. They're really just all carbon. They're hydrocarbons. And there's one type of plastic that does have some nitrogen in it, and that's nylon. But other than that, plastics do not have, that we know of, any phosphorus content.
So
what we think is really what this is providing is a type of reef or a place for microbes just to live, almost like an apartment complex for them, a structure for them to live in,
yeah,
and an unnatural one at that. And we'd like to know more about how this is affecting this delicate environment and perhaps creating an imbalance.
So is it perhaps that the microbes are eating something else and their excreta is breaking down this plastic?
Sure. Yeah. So typically, what's known about plastics degradation is that enzymes are produced that are excreted out from the organism, and then these enzymes actually melt or break these hydrocarbon bonds.
So they're probably eating something else.
Yeah, it's very, very possible. I mean, they can't live on plastic alone, that's for sure. And why they would be degrading this is unclear this time. You know, we're going to have to do more work. But but the surprising thing to us was that these things were there. And another big question is who are these things that are on the plastics? Could it possibly be carrying certain things that could be responsible for toxic blooms or be carrying pathogens and bad microbes that could in fact and harm the marine life in this delicate environment? So that's something we're also looking into.
Mm-hmm. I see that from your work that you have dived in the Bering Sea off Alaska, the Bahamas, Sea of Cortez, Mexico, the Virgin Islands, Hawaii, and the Tofino Inlet in Vancouver. What about those experiences? I mean, how do you give that up if you've had those experiences and sit in a lab?
Right, right. I think it's, I mean, what's really important in my work is to be able to get out and be in the natural environment for if at least just a short while and really push the reset button and realize why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yes, yes.
You know, we study the environment in test tubes, but it's great to see it all in
context. Like Jane Goodall spends most of her time politically active trying to save the chimps, but when she needs to recharge, she goes to Gombe and she sits among them and she remembers her inspiration. So I would imagine you as a scientist would do the same.
Absolutely.
Cool. Now you have, you're lead author on at least four publications that I found. You have several in progress. What is your most important, let's say, current research?
Yeah, well, certainly, I'm involved as well in mercury detoxification in the ocean and the roles that microbes play in that. I have a program in drug discovery looking at exotic microbes from the ocean and the types of chemistry that they produce and the applications for that for human health.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you could figure out a way to maybe treat some of these fish that come up with lots of mercury, would you actually treat the meat to eliminate the mercury or the ecosystem itself?
Well, the idea that we're seeing now is that perhaps you've heard of these growing anoxic regions in the ocean where oxygen is being stripped out, and largely because of nutrients being from runoff from land.
Right.
Is one of the major causes.
Yeah.
These anoxic zones, we think, are actually preventing certain microbes that normally take methylmercury and mercury 2, which are quite toxic, and turn them into mercury 0 or elemental mercury, which then is volatile and goes off into much less toxic and
oh, really?
Off into the atmosphere. Yes,
oh, cool.
It's a natural process that's carried out by microbes, and you know,
cool.
It's been a trait that you know they typically have, but only microbes that can live. It seems at least that microbes that live in an oxygenated environment can perform this role, and so we're investigating that more deeply and understanding this detoxification.
So you're working with the aerobic bacteria. Yeah, well, we here on the Sound Shore of Westchester County are familiar with apoxia and hypoxia because we have long been schooled that runoff from fertilizers into the ocean causes the undesirable elements to just bloom, as you say, and chew up all or most of the oxygen, killing so many of the native wildlife. Okay, we have to take another break for the last time. You'll wait for us and be back. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460, New Rochelle, New York. I am Bob Levinsohn. This is Environmentally Sound. My guest is Dr. Tracy Mincer, and we will be right back.
world and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu, the man in charge of ensuring our security honored.
You're not only one of the longest serving secretaries of defense in American history, but it is also clear that you've been one of the best.
President Obama speaking just before presenting the outgoing defense secretary with a Medal of Freedom, Robert Gates.
Appointed by one president, leaving under another, he oversaw the surge in Iraq, Afghanistan, and military operations in Libya. He'll be replaced by Leon Panetta.
Fox Radio's Mike Makowicz. A Missouri River levee in southwest Iowa failing this morning, while in parts of North Dakota, floodwaters are receding, leaving behind a different set of problems.
When summer is through, more than 1,000 school children in Minot, North Dakota, need new places to attend classes because last week's flood of the Souris River severely damaged two elementary schools and a middle school was submerged to the roofline.
Fox Radio's Sal Giangrasso and the Dow up in anticipation of Greece clearing the way for a debt rescue package. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Hi, this is Tom Merriam. Join Bill Meth and me this Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, here on WVOX 1460 AM for a special July 4th weekend edition of the Metro Golf Show. We'll speak with the winner of the Ike Championship, one of the top local tournaments, and we'll also talk with Westchester County Executive Rob Astorino about the state of the county golf courses and his own success on the golf course. We'll also have a very special July 4th weekend Metro Golf Show tour stop at a special course built especially for injured war veterans. Plus the Bridgestone Golf Tip of the Week and a look ahead to the Constellation Energy Senior Players Championship to be played at the Westchester Country Club. You'll get all that and even more this Saturday and every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock on what the New York Daily News calls the best local radio show covering golf. The Metro Golf Show on WVOX and WVOX.com. So tune us in before you tee off. The Metro Golf Show is sponsored in part by the Mohegan Sun, Barbados Tourism, the Constellation Energy Senior Players Championship, and Bridgestone Golf.
Making you feel so good at work, you'll say,
this job is the greatest.
AM 1460, WVOX, New Rochelle, and WVOX Worldwide.
1460, WVOX.
Okay, we are back. We have one segment left of about 10 minutes. We are speaking with Dr. Tracy Mincer of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. I have several questions to ask you, but before we proceed, Dr. Mincer, just tell us a little bit about Woods Hole. We've all heard of it. It's a very famous institute. Just give us a couple of minutes about that.
Right. We're the largest private oceanographic institution in the world. And there's about just over 100 scientists who had their own laboratories here, and a huge amount of technical staff. We have a large ocean-going scientific fleet. We're pioneers in robotics in the ocean and monitoring the ocean, study everything from really atmosphere to the core of the planet.
Wow.
And everything in between.
Wow. And you're funded by, is it public funding or private funding, a combination?
A little bit. So there's big funding is from National Science Foundation, but also the Navy and private foundations and collaborations with industry.
Interesting. Okay, it's very interesting. It's quite a prestigious organization, I think you must be very happy to be working there.
Right, great
now,
work.
The Sargasso Sea, we touched on that before. It's 1.4 million square miles, mm-hmm. And the visibility is like you can see for 2,000 feet through the water. Is that
2,000? I'm not sure if that's possible, but it's extremely high visibility. I mean, up to 200 feet, I believe. Yeah.
Well, unless I read it wrong when I researched it, the Wikipedia said 2,000, but okay.
2,000. Yeah, that's amazing. I think the properties of water. Anyway, it's extremely clear. What's called an oligotrophic type ocean system, and so very few particles there. Very clear waters.
Okay, well, I'll have to take another look and see if I got it wrong. I seem to... okay, well, we'll see how much the visibility is off the air. You told me an amusing anecdote about how a 5-gallon bucket was found with two triggerfish hundreds, if not thousands, of miles from where they should have been found. Tell us about that.
Right, right. Well, a surprising thing about how this big whirlpool or gyre works is that if a piece of plastic is dropped off the eastern seaboard, for example, a plastic bottle, it can take as little as 40 days to arrive into the center of this whirlpool in this in the Sargasso Sea. And apparently this happened to a couple of triggerfish that were really, they're only reef-type fish and never are out in the open ocean. You just don't see them out there. They were, when a plastic bucket was seen floating on the surface during the recent SEA cruise, they pulled this bucket up and there was two of these triggerfish in there. And it was like this bucket was a small ocean-going vessel for them. And they had traveled many hundreds of miles and were in the center of this region where they just don't belong and are not adapted to.
So this bucket was, you called it actually a spaceship.
Exactly. Like a spaceship. Yeah, it seemed like it was some kind of way for them to travel through space.
So this suggests ways that perhaps things have migrated over the eons. Maybe they got themselves caught onto something that went beyond their area and they clung to it because it was all they knew.
Right, right. And that gets at the problems of plastics in the ocean. There's really not many substrates, you know, perhaps large logs and things like that that could have fulfilled that role earlier before plastics were introduced
right.
into the ocean. But, you know, seaweeds, things like that all degrade pretty quickly, whereas plastics can be around for many, many years.
But wood does,
durable.
Driftwood does last for quite a while.
Shipworms tend to degrade it pretty quickly.
Really?
So there's these worms and other microbes that can degrade it very quickly, but it can have a long life.
Well, here's a scenario. A fish that gets caught inside one of those logs just eats all of those things that are trying to eat the wood, and that's their maintenance of the house. That's probably ridiculous.
Sure. Well, I think in this plastic bucket that there could have been some of that going on. It seemed like they had their own little reef around them. There was barnacles. There was
and they were eating.
It's possible they were eating some of that and scraping. Triggerfish like to scrape algae off of surfaces, and so they were perhaps getting something from that.
But they couldn't really.
It's unsustainable. I don't know.
They couldn't really scrape barnacles, though.
I don't think so. But they
were healthy, though.
Yeah. Although when their gut contents were analyzed, they were just their stomachs were full of plastic bits, and so once they were in the center of this area, it seemed that they were eating bits of plastic and things. And
so they probably would have perished.
Quite likely. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about microbial diversity a little bit. You've given me this analogy. When you take a tree, you didn't say how big the tree was, but let's just say an average-sized tree. If you just take a penny-sized area, that is the extent of other than microbial life, and the rest of the tree is all microbes?
Right. So you can look at all of cellular life in the form of what's called a type of tree, and look at these evolutionary type relationships amongst living things. And everything that we can see with our naked eye is really, if you're looking at a tree that's the size of a normal sheet of paper, something the size of a penny on this tree is everything that we can see. And all these other branches on this tree with all the other domains of life are microbial.
Well, how big did you say the tree would be?
A sheet of paper.
Oh, okay. So, Mm-hmm. So it probably we're 1%, would you say? The things we can see are probably 1% and 99% or somewhere in that order?
It's a lot less than that. The microbial life is just, as we learn more about it, is really... The most abundant life and the most diverse life that's out there. And so this tree is very bushy, if you will.
So are we talking about biomass or biodiversity?
Both.
Oh, so biomass as well. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. What I'd like to touch on, we have a couple of minutes left, is viruses. Are you knowledgeable about such things?
Sure.
Okay. I think I'm quoting you when I say that you said pathogens are symbionts in the making. Is that accurate?
Right, right. That's a current idea that's out there in the field.
Okay, now let's just simplify it for people who perhaps don't think scientifically. Pathogens are disease vectors, basically?
Right. A pathogen can be any organism that is the cause of a disease, I would say.
Okay. And a symbiont is any organism that survives in conjunction with another, and they keep each other going and they keep each other alive, right?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Okay, but then again, viruses are not living things. So, hence why you say pathogens are symbionts in the making. But then again, can you be a symbiont without being alive? I guess probably you can.
Right, right. I mean, I think that viruses can actually make perhaps there's situations where a virus can make a population more fit by introducing genes that can help them adapt. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the three scenarios, if a virus attacks an organism, is it can kill the organism can eliminate it or control it, or they can get into a situation where there's a dynamic between them, and that is what could lead to growth. And as Lynn Margulis in Inquiring Genome says, they could actually cause speciation, where a new species is created by that acquisition of a genome.
Right, right. I agree.
Okay, all right. Well, I was hoping you would do more than agree. you said something about phytoplankton, and I don't remember what it was, but I have the word phytoplankton. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So phytoplankton are very abundant in the upper layers of the ocean where light can penetrate. In the Sargasso Sea, that photic zone is about 200 meters or so, something like that, in that upper layer.
And what do they do?
Mm-hmm.
What do they do?
So, the phytoplankton harvest light. They're little tiny plants, and they harvest light and produce oxygen, and have a, unlike, they produce, in our oceans, they produce just as much oxygen as all the land plants do. So it's
really
about 50-50.
Really?
Right?
So just phytoplankton?
Right, yeah, phytoplankton. And the one big difference really is that these phytoplankton live and die and turn over every day.
Wow.
So on average.
Fascinating. Okay, Dr. Tracy Mincer, we have to leave you now, but thank you so much for your fascinating insights and work.
Okay, Bob.
Thank you, sir.
For having me.
My pleasure. I'd like to thank Dr. Tracy Mincer for making time for us today. The oceans are in a bad state because of human activity. Oceanographers study and chronicle their condition. We ignore them at our peril. If there's much more degradation, source of food on planet Earth will no longer be able to provide sustenance, and life all over the world will be degraded. But then again, what I do is chronicle the demise of Homo sapiens. This is just part of it. The contamination of the seas is one giant step in that demise. Our thought for the week: in all things, success depends upon previous preparation. Without such preparation, there is sure to be failure. Stay tuned for Howard Sterman, the peerless publisher who broke the Wiener story. I am Bob Levensold, chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. Thank you very much for listening. Remember to be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You are here. It is now. Health, happiness to you all.